Hi, good evening. Thank you all for coming out tonight. In a moment, I'll introduce our guest speaker. The Committee on Open Government is responsible for overseeing the implementation of the Freedom of Information Law, as you know, and the Open Meetings Law. The Freedom of Information Law governs the right to access government records. The Open Meetings Law concerns the conduct of meetings of public bodies and the right for people to attend those meetings. When questions come up under either of these laws, the committee, which our guest speaker chairs, can provide written or oral advice, and they do. Since its inception, over 25,000, I believe it's 25,000 written advisory opinions have been...
Getting close? Yeah.
It's more than 20, maybe a little less than 25, but it's close. And in addition to that, a lot of oral opinions have been given over the phone. If you have a problem with that, this is the office that you call. Robert Freeman. He is the executive director for the Committee on Open Government. Went to Georgetown. Has a law degree from New York University. And I can go on and on and on, but I know he doesn't like people to waste his time. He operates one of the few government offices in the country that have been established just to monitor and assist in the administration of public access to information laws. And that's one of the reasons, or the reason, you guys are here. So he's authored a lot of things. How many times have you given presentations, Mr. Freeman?
Oh, my God. Too many to count.
Too many to count. He is the authority on this issue. He's who superintendents, government officials call when they have questions on this subject. So it's my honor to introduce Mr. Freeman.
Thank you so much.
An introduction. Before anything else, I simply want to say to you that I am here for you. Somebody asked if I had an agenda. I have no agenda. I invite you to ask questions throughout. I can talk about this stuff from now until hell freezes over if you let me. But if you do, we'll miss the issues that are really important or troubling to you. So after a very brief introductory remark, I want you to fire away. And I will stay as long as you have questions. Does anybody not have our little handout? A few of you. Thanks.
I'll do that.
Yeah, that's okay.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Ready? This is our basic guide to both FOIL, the Freedom of Information Law, and the Open Meetings Law. If you make requests, if you're from government and you deal with requests, you should have it with you all the time. Why? It simply enables you to have a clue what the laws are about. It enables you to resolve problems before they become issues. Sure. Many of you have heard the phrase executive session, a portion of a meeting that can be closed. This lists verbatim the grounds for entering into executive session. It lists the grounds for withholding records under FOIL. On page 3 is our website address. Has anybody visited our website?
Not yet.
A few people. We have a ton of information that's available online, including this, the text of the laws, frequently asked questions. Superintendent Sharkey mentioned that we write advisory legal opinions. We have, and we've written well over 20,000. They are indexed by subject matter. One index deals with COIL, the other the Open Meetings Law. So if you have a question about a particular kind of record or an element of either law, it's an intuitive kind of index. You think of the word or the phrase, you find it alphabetically. The opinions prepared since 1993 are available online in full text. If you can't find it that way, on the page with the alphabet, we have a search box. Just type in the word or the phrase that comes to mind. That will connect you, again, with the full text of opinions. So there's a lot of information there. Committee on Open Government, I should tell you a little bit about it. I'm a state employee. I work for the Department of State. The staff is 3 of us at full strength. We are the smallest state agency that actually does anything. Leave the rest to your imagination. You've dealt with state before, huh? And I have what I've considered forever, at least it seems that way, to be the best job in state government. On many days, I am mystified that they pay me to do what I do. And for all I know, there are people here in the crowd who say the same thing, but for completely different reasons. I've somewhat jokingly suggested that I've upset everybody in government at least once over the course of the past 35 years. Our goal is really simple. We give what we believe to be the right answer under the law, regardless of who asks the question. So we're not there to support the government. We're there to do the right thing. Now, I'm not suggesting that the government does the wrong thing, but we don't care whether it is John or Jane Q. Public who makes an inquiry, or somebody from the governor's office, a local government agency, a member of the news media. It doesn't matter. Again, our only goal is to give the right answer under the law, irrespective of who asks the question. So it's a very unusual function. I have been blessed in a variety of ways. I have no civil service protection. I'm on my sixth governor. My guess is that I'll be on the seventh in about 14 months. We'll see. Look, it's not a secret. It's not a secret. Everybody knows the poll numbers. And I hope to stick around for a while. I hope that you leave tonight with the general notion that both of the laws that we're talking about are based primarily on common sense. All they really say, all they should ever say, is that everything is open unless disclosure would hurt. Either somebody, in terms of an invasion of privacy, the government, in terms of its ability to do its job well on behalf of the public, or on occasion, a private company in relation to its competition. So the key question in so many instances is, what would happen if the government had to disclose? And unless the answer in the gut is, ouch, this would really hurt, disclosure ordinarily should be the rule. Now, obviously that's a generalization, but that is the thrust of both of these laws, a presumption of openness. A presumption of openness. I don't know how many of you are from government, but I have to suggest to government people all the time that embarrassment is not one of the grounds for closing a meeting. It's not one of the grounds for withholding records, and yet we all know damn well that embarrassment is a primary motivator for so many of our activities in and outside of government. I'm going to leave these here. Where's our hostess? You know, I didn't thank Christine Maggio. Does everybody know Christine? Christine really did the legwork for this event. She has been absolutely fabulous. I think it's great that there are so many of you here tonight, and it looks as though there are going to be more and more and more, which is terrific. And, you know, our goal, my goal, is to provide you with knowledge regarding the laws. If you're from government, you should be able to interpret the laws more effectively to comply with them. If you are members of the public, I hope this is your opportunity to find out how to use these laws best and most effectively. And I said to somebody over the phone, one of the great elements of an event like this is that I have no idea who you are. I don't know whether you're on the town board or the school board. I don't know whether you're the local lunatic, and every town has at least one. She's laughing. Maybe she's the one. I don't know. I don't know whether you're the local reporter. I just don't know, and I don't care. I don't care. But now is the time for everybody here to hear the same questions and the same answers at the same time. And my hope is that that tends to resolve, let's call them issues that perhaps can avoid being turned into problems. So, and with that, I'm all yours. What do you like? FOIL, open meetings law? Where should we start? Preference? Anybody have a preference? Nobody has a preference? Start with FOIL. Good start. I think that it's the more important of the two laws. The open meetings law unquestionably is really important. It gives the public a window that otherwise would not exist. We have the ability to go to meetings of so-called public bodies, the school board, the town board, the zoning board of appeals, the planning board, those entities that consist of either elected or appointed officials who carry out a governmental function for all of us. Why is it important? We have the right to observe them in the flesh and in action. We can find out who on the board is sleeping, who's awake, who's smart, who's not, who's well prepared, who's never prepared. We can figure out who to elect the next time around. And it seems to me that that is a critical element of the democratic process. And again, the open meetings law gives us the opportunity to know who's doing the job well and maybe who's not. But in the scheme of things, I think that FOIL is more important. Why? FOIL deals with records. The record, in so many ways, is forever. Maybe the school board took action at a meeting 3 years ago that involved a heated debate that lasted 3 hours.
Hmm.
During the debate, people said brilliant things, they said ridiculous things. What remains, though, probably is the three-line resolution. That is in the record. The rest, to a great extent, will have been forgotten. So the record, again, I believe, is most significant. A point to make about FOIL right from the start. The title of the law is wrong. It is misleading. Why? It's not an access to information law. It's not a vehicle that gives John or Jane Q. Public the right to cross-examine public officials. Certainly, people in government can choose to answer your questions. We do it all the time. But that is separate from any responsibility imposed by FOIL. FOIL deals with existing records, and it does not require that a government agency create a new record in response to a request for information. Okay. Any questions about that? Not yet? Okay. Equally important, our law defines what a record is. You'd think that that would be an ingredient in every access to records law. It's not. You look at the Federal Freedom of Information Act, sort of the grandfather of access laws in the United States. It has never told us what a federal government agency record is. To this day, there are issues that sort of percolate through the federal courts, which involve who prepared it, where did it come from, what is its function. All of those issues were resolved here by 1978, when, for all intents and purposes, our current version of FOIL went into effect. And to be completely honest, when we were drafting it in 77, yes, I was around in 77 to do that, we had no idea what the future would bring. Think about 1977. You probably can't think about 1977. Yeah. High tech was an electric hybrid. We used carbon paper. Nobody could have dreamed of anything like the internet. Email, what the hell is that? Nobody would have known what you were talking about. And how do you have a telephone without a cord? Impossible. It's science fiction. It's science fiction. So we've come a long way. And again, when we were drafting the law, that was the beginning of the era of computers, let's put it that way. I won't even say information technology. It was in its infancy. But we got lucky. And since 78, our law has defined the term record to mean any information in any physical form whatsoever. Kept, held, filed, produced, or reproduced by, with, or for a government agency. A school district, a county, a town, a village, a state agency, a public authority, if they have information in some physical form, whether it's the 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that you have in front of you, the content of a database, email, microfilm, videotape, tape recording, anything that stores information by or for a government agency is a record that falls within the coverage of FOIL. The extent to which it's public is the next question. And again, the content and the effects of disclosure will determine what's public and what's not. Questions? There have to be questions. Somebody break the ice.
The contents and the effects will determine.
Yeah.
How?
How?
The contents and...
What kind of record do you think you want to get from government? Anybody, give me an example. Yeah.
An elected official's personal notes.
Personal notes.
From a meeting.
From a meeting. Huh. Interesting question. Anybody here remember the Moonies?
Yes.
Remember the Moonies? Unification Church?
Well, no, no, no.
The Moonies were involved in a dispute with the Board of Regents. They went to the meetings, they got the minutes, and they said, thanks for the minutes, but Mr. Secretary to the Board, we want your personal notes. He said, they're mine. The court said, they are records as defined by the law. The court reviewed them in camera, in private, and found that they consisted merely of a factual rendition of what occurred at the meeting. Therefore, they were public, because factual information within those internal kinds of documents are public. Now, if he had written something like, these people are crazy, that would have been an opinion. And opinions within those internal governmental communications may be withheld. They don't have to be, but they may be. So that's why I'm suggesting to you that it's the content that will determine what's public and what's not. Does that help you a little bit?
So if we requested certain information, they could send it, but there may only be four words on the paper and everything else.
That's conceivable. I mean, that's what we all see coming out of Washington, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that that's changing. We'll see. We'll see. Should we get political for a minute?
Sure.
Should I get political?
Yes.
Everybody remember the name John Ashcroft? Remember John Ashcroft, the Attorney General? Yeah, well, you know, when he became AG, he walked into the building that houses the Justice Department, and there was statuary. You remember that? They were nudes. He had them covered up. I knew we were in goddamn trouble. I knew we were in trouble. But getting to freedom of information, he sent a memorandum to federal agencies that said pretty much, if you have a shred of reason for withholding the record that's been requested, do it, and we will defend you in court. Huh. Huh. Last year, the beginning of this year, after President Obama took office, he issued a directive to federal agencies which says, in essence, that it's our job to disclose that FOIA, the Federal Freedom of Information Act, is based, like the New York law, on a presumption of access, and unless disclosure would result in some identifiable harm, disclose, even though the law may not require disclosure. He also, in that memo, discussed a phrase that we had been using in our annual reports to the governor and the legislature for a couple of years, proactive disclosure. I don't know whether it's really common or whether he stole it from us, but proactive disclosure involves government agencies making records available primarily online before anybody requests it. And when that occurs, it's a win-win situation. You get the stuff simply because it's there on the website for the taking. At the same time, the government agency doesn't have to deal with the Freedom of Information request. It saves time and money and effort. And I'm going to guess your school district has a website, right? You put all kinds of stuff on it, right? Yeah. Minutes of your meetings?
Yes.
Yeah. Nobody has to write to the school district clerk or the superintendent under Freedom of Information. If you've got an internet connection, say, I hereby request such and such under the Freedom of Information law. Again, the records are simply there for the taking. Makes life easy for everybody. And that really, I think, is one of the bases of FOIA. Make life easy. It's based to a great extent on reasonableness. There is a hand someplace. Yeah.
I'm trying to get records from the federal government.
Yeah.
Through the VA.
Yeah.
Things that I witnessed in war and medical records. I've had Gerald Solomon try. Now
you're going back a long way.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the response? Or is it no response?
Not really any response.
What are they telling you?
They're saying to whoever helps me research will use records that they don't exist, but I know they exist.
Why do you know that they exist?
Well, some stuff I'm looking for is the police blotter.
From?
From Saigon.
Let me make a point or two.
Yes.
The government doesn't necessarily have to keep records forever. There may be, you're talking about probably the late 60s or early 70s.
I just helped the major write a paper, his thesis, on the Tet Offensive, and he's a major in the CID, the military police. He couldn't get information that's there.
Well, let's assume, let's look at this from a couple of points of view, and I have to tell you, I'm not an expert on the federal act. I know something about it, but again, the federal act deals with existing records. If they're gone, they're gone. One of the things that you can do under the New York Freedom of Information law, if you make a request and they say, sorry, we don't have it, you can ask for what is called a certification. It's like an affidavit where somebody from the government agency has to swear in writing, sorry, we no longer maintain the record, or we could not locate it after having made a diligent search. I don't know of any similar requirement under the federal act, but assuming that what you're talking about exists, much of what you're mentioning pertains to you, which means that you would have a right to get it primarily under the Federal Privacy Act. The Federal Privacy Act generally gives the subjects of records rights of access to those records about themselves. One of the issues, though, and I think that this is more important than most people would recognize, both the federal and the state law say that an applicant must reasonably describe the records. reasonably described. What does that mean?
I'll tell you a story. It's a true story. It's about a real bad guy. I can say that. He spent a lot of years in state correctional facilities. He died there. Harold Boom Boom Konigsberg.
Some of you may even know the name. You look like you know the name. Boom Boom wrote to the Department of Correctional Services and pretty much said, I want everything that you can find by means of my name or my ID number. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, I want it all. Well, they came up with 2,300 pages of material and then said, what do you want? He said, I want all of it. They said, sorry, you haven't reasonably described the records. Sue us.
Well, Boom Boom had, let's say, unusual associates, had the resources to go all the way to the state's highest court, Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said two things. Number one, Department, you were able to locate all these records based upon the terms of his request. Therefore, Boom Boom met the responsibility of reasonably describing the records. Now it's your job, agency, to go through the stuff to figure out what's public and what's not. Point two, and this is really the key point. The court said, in essence, whether or the extent to which a request reasonably describes the records may be dependent upon the nature of an agency's filing or record-keeping system. Let me give you my silly, stupid example. What county do you live in? Green. Let's say that here in the school district offices, you see the Green County phone directory. Huh. What's your last name? You can lie if you want.
Thompson.
I hereby request all the listings in the phone book pertaining to those people whose last name is Thompson. Piece of cake, right? That's how the phone book is written. Last name, alphabetical order. Even if there are 10,000 Thompsons, the request would reasonably describe. What's your first name?
Douglas.
Not an uncommon name. Huh. Same person walks in the next day and says, now I want all the listings concerning those people whose first name is Douglas. Well, gee, the request is specific. You know that there are Douglases there, but you can't find them unless you go through thousands of listings one by one. That's when the government agency would have the ability to say, sorry, we maintain this grouping of records by last name in alphabetical order, not by first name. We're not required to go through the haystack in an effort to find the needles, even though we know that they're there somewhere. Your request does not reasonably describe the records. But let's go a step further. Let's say that it's 2009, and they maintain the equivalent of the phone book electronically. And somebody can sit at the keyboard and type in Douglas and pull them all out. Well, if they can do that, under our New York Freedom of Information law, yes, the government agency is required to do so. If the government has the ability to extract and retrieve, whatever it may be, through entering queries, through, again, use of the keyboard, the law now says that a government agency has to do that to comply with the law. So I don't know if that helps you. I hope it has at least a little bit. More questions? Yeah.
I could help that gentleman.
Good.
He's dealing with the Veterans Affairs.
Yep.
That's a governmental agency.
Sure.
They're
not
going to help him work. They're not going to help him at all. He's got to go through the DAV.
What's the DAV?
Disabled American Vets.
Are you hearing this?
Yeah, I already have. I'm with the DAV, and I have a lawyer out in Chicago.
They work pretty much for free. The investigators work for free. It took me 30 years to get my 100%. I was in Vietnam also. It took me 30 years, but I got it. And they owe me 20 years of back pay.
Now you're a rich man.
No, they got to pay me first.
They got a book, so you don't have money yet. You mean it's the Jerry Maguire principles. Remember that? Show me the money. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you go back to the point you made that but they don't have to keep these records? I mean, what keeps them from just destroying them?
Anybody here from a local government? Yeah. Okay. Are you familiar with the retention schedules?
Yeah.
This will tell you we have too many laws in New York. Anybody here ever hear of the Arts and Cultural Affairs Law? Huh. Well, there are provisions in the Arts and Cultural Affairs Law which deal with the retention and disposal of records. And in a nutshell, the Commissioner of Education, through the State Archives, is responsible for developing schedules which indicate minimum retention periods for various kinds of records. The retention period is based upon the significance of the record. Just to give you an example,
minutes of a meeting of the town board, the village board, the school board, they're essentially the official record of a meeting of the governing body of a public corporation. They have to be kept permanently. Let's say, though, that the school board or the town board or the village board tape records its meetings. Usually they do as a means of ensuring the accuracy of the minutes. The tape recording, according to the schedule, has to be kept for 4 months. At that point, it can be discarded, erased, reused, whatever. So the schedules will determine how long records must be kept before they can be tossed. There are schedules also that deal with federal agency records, state agency records. That's why I said right at the start that government doesn't necessarily have to keep records forever. It may choose to do so. In fact, how many of you remember who was the mayor of Albany for all those years?
Corning.
Something you never forget. Soon after he died, I got a call from a reporter from the now-defunct Knickerbocker News. Some of you may remember that. And the reporter said, I'd like to see the Corning papers. And I said, what are the Corning papers? She told me that the city of Albany, over the course of years, had accumulated 900,000 documents. Corning apparently kept everything he ever got, kept copies of everything he ever sent out. Hundreds of thousands of those records could legally have been discarded, but they were there. They were there. If you know the city of Albany, when they got the request, they wanted to avoid the certainty of embarrassment. And they said, a couple of categories of these documents are not records covered by FOIL. They involve the mayor acting in a personal capacity. They involve the mayor acting in his capacity as political party leader. Well, the newspaper wrote to me, asked for an opinion. And in about 7 pages, I pretty much said, City of Albany, if you've got them, they're records that fall within the coverage of FOIL. Court of Appeals unanimously agreed. So even in a situation in which records can legally be destroyed, if they continue to exist, they continue to fall within the coverage of FOIL. Okay? Does that help you?
Yeah.
Good.
My concern is schedule, when things get, disappear, or they, the
records. They're not supposed
destroyed.
To disappear.
Yeah.
If you're interested, the schedule is called the MU1, municipal, whatever it is, for towns, and it's there. And you can find it in the State Education Department's website. Click on the archives and you'll be able to locate it. Okay. More questions? Yeah.
Email.
How long do you have to keep email? Email is simply a means of communicating a record. The schedule will be dependent upon the nature of the record, as in the case of any other record. Some emails, I assume, can be discarded instantly. If you write to me tomorrow and you say, hey, Bob, that was really good, let's get together for lunch, chances are pretty good that the email can be obliterated instantly because it really doesn't have a heck of a lot of value. On the other hand, if you transmit a statement of policy to your staff, and that's the only version of it that exists, it's not in paper, it's maintained electronically only, the schedule will indicate that it has to be retained for a lengthy period of time. I don't know what that period might be. But again, it's the nature of the record and its significance that would determine how long that it has to be kept. Email, from my perspective, should be treated in exactly the same way you think about paper. The paper record, for purposes of retention and disposal, for purposes of FOIL, is treated the same way if it exists in email as it would in the old-fashioned way. I don't know if that helps you. You probably have a records manager. And the State Archives has really provided pretty good and detailed guidance regarding information technology, regarding the preservation of records, including email. And it is difficult. One of the real difficulties is, and I hope everybody from government knows this, you hit the delete key, it's still there. It's still there, which means that it may be subject to FOIL, and in a lawsuit, it may be subject to discovery and litigation. So often the only way you can get rid of it is with a sledgehammer that you bang on the hard drive and then it's really gone. It's become a huge issue. One of those things that we just didn't anticipate a very few years ago.
So the technology in a lot of ways has made life easy, but in a lot of others it's made life very difficult. How many of you have said to yourself, email,
blessing or curse?
Which is it?
Especially young people, you expect instant gratification. People expect instant responses
when we receive and transmit whatever it may be via email. I think it's kind of unrealistic when we get so much of it these days. We have to put it in line just the way we used to when we got the stuff on paper. Yeah?
What are the repercussions if you ask for a record that was supposed to have been kept on file but isn't there?
There's a line from a song, I suppose. Absolutely nothing. Say it again, you know. If it's gone, it's gone. If it's gone, it's gone. I suppose the repercussion involves what I call the court of public opinion. You know, if it's clear that a government agency is destroying records when it shouldn't be, gee, maybe the people who head up those agencies won't be able to keep their jobs, won't be reelected, whatever. It's all a matter of accountability. But if you're talking about a failure to comply with law, I don't know of any particular remedy. Now, for what it's worth, there's a provision in FOIL which has a companion in the penal law which deals with what I've come to call the bad faith response. You request a record and the person in the government agency says, sorry, we don't have it, and they know that they do. Or if they destroy it to prevent you from getting it, then that's when you go to the DA because that's a violation of the penal law. Most government agencies don't lie. Most of them say, we have it, but you can't have it. Instead of, sorry, we don't have it. More questions? Yeah.
Can a government agency implement their own policy and procedures regarding FOIL requests?
Not only can they, but they must. But let me give you a touch of background. Again, our function at the Committee on Open Government is advisory in nature. We can't tell a government agency what to disclose or what to withhold. Certainly we can advise, we can offer opinions, but we can't direct, we can't compel. The one area of the law which gives us a degree of authority involves our obligation to develop procedural rules and regulations. In turn, every government agency, every city, county, town, village, state agency is required to develop its own based upon ours. So, just as an example, and some of you know this, one of the elements of our regulation says that every government agency is required to designate at least one so-called records access officer. That is the person who has the duty of coordinating the agency's response to requests. In most towns, it's the town clerk. In villages, it's the village clerk. In the school district, often it's the school district clerk. It doesn't have to be any of those people, but there has to be at least one. There has to be at least one. And there are various elements of the regs with which every unit of government must comply by adopting its own regs consistent with ours. Okay. Just as an example, anybody here from Long Island? Where are you from?
Hicksville.
Land of Billy Joel.
Yes.
And the Coletti brothers. Do you remember them? They played baseball in the late 1950s. Did you go to school with Billy Joel?
No.
You're too young.
He went to the public school. I didn't go to public school.
Oh, okay. Anybody else from Long Island? Yeah, where?
Comac.
Comac. My son in law's from Comac. Yeah. Centerport, Suffolk County. Long Island these days is the land of hostility. It really is. It's the place where people would rather sue than talk for 5 minutes. It's true. I think it's a tough place to live. I grew up in East Meadow. I tell people Long Island is a good place to be from. And I really believe that to be so. But in any case, the reason I'm going there was a guy who was requesting records from a village, a small village, and they said, you can only look at these records for an hour a day. 1 hour a week, in fact. And our regulations indicate that people have the right to make requests and to view records during regular business hours. And he had to sue. And he won. The court cited our regs and said, it's regular business hours. Another case, if you are denied access to a record, the law says that you have the right to appeal. The appeal either goes to the governing body, the school board, the town board, etc., or somebody designated by the governing body. Our regulations say that when an agency denies a request, it has to tell the applicant about the right to appeal and to whom the appeal can be made. Well, there was a guy who was not informed, and he went to court. And the agency said, wait a minute, you didn't appeal. You have no right to be here yet. And the state's highest court looked at our regulations and said, agency, you can't complain because you did not inform so-and-so of his right to appeal. Yes, he does have the right to be in court. Okay? So the regulations have the force and effect of law. They deal solely with procedure. Okay? More questions? Yeah?
Are the appeal and the rejections and all this public record?
Are they public?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, yeah.
Yeah, so if
yeah. And they, when an agency gets an appeal, it's supposed to send our office a copy as well as its determination.
Well, even the requests are public?
Generally speaking, requests are public. I say generally. There's a, let's talk about what's public and what's not. Should we do that? Again, we start off with the general notion that all records are available except those records or portions of records that fall within a series of exceptions to rights of access. I think my favorite is the one that says that government can withhold to the extent that disclosure would result in an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. That's pretty much the standard in the United States, unwarranted invasion of privacy. You see the same phrase in the Federal Act. I always ask the crowd, you're shaking your head, yes. Anybody know what that means? Unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. Nobody knows what it means. Nobody will ever know what it means. There isn't a judge alive who's in a better position than any of you to make judgments about privacy. And the reality is that as a society, our feelings about privacy are always changing. I give an example these days that has nothing to do with FOIL. Anybody here ever see the Victoria's Secrets ads on the tube? Huh? Nobody has?
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah, he takes them, I can tell. Would those ads have been aired 10 or 15 years ago? No. People say no. Well, gee, why do we see them on network TV now? It seems that the sensibilities of society in the United States have changed. What used to be maybe offensive to many is not quite so offensive to lots of people. So that's why we see the ads. Another reality. Anybody here have teenagers, kids in their 20s? Yeah? Mm-hmm. How about that Facebook stuff? Kids put stuff out there in cyberspace about themselves that we never put out there because we're old. You know? I mean, that's the simple truth. Our view of privacy is different from that of our kids. Third reality. Two equally reasonable people can look at the same items and disagree. I use my own life as an example all the time. We used to have sort of a joke in the house. If the phone rang after 9 o'clock, it was either my mother-in-law or a reporter who'd gotten kicked out of a meeting. Not the school board meeting here. Not that, I don't know. They call me a lot at work, but sometimes they call me at home, at night, on the weekend. Doesn't bother me. It's simply part of the job. My name, my home address, my home phone number are in the white pages. Anybody can get them. Anybody can get them. My wife, on the other hand, uses a different name. She'd never put that name in the phone book with a home address and a home phone number. Why? Two reasons. First is painfully obvious. She doesn't want to be associated with me. It's not that funny. Come on. Rodney's dead. You know, now I get no respect. Second, and I think more importantly, she's a psychotherapist. She doesn't want her clients calling her at home on her home phone number, knowing where she lives, knowing that she's married to me, knowing that we have, in the eyes of the world, in some circumstances, just too many kids. She has perfectly good and valid reasons for saying no, never. I have equally valid reasons for saying, I don't care, and never the twain shall meet. So what do we do about privacy? Huh. Well, the courts have gone off pretty much in two branches. One of them deals with the privacy of ordinary people who happen to be identified in government records. And the Court of Appeals has pretty much told us, react from the gut. What would the reasonable person of ordinary sensibilities feel about disclosure of this item? Is it one of those things where you'd say to yourself, where the average person would say to himself or herself, this is offensive, this is intimate, it's highly personal, it's nobody's business?
If that's the feeling in your gut,
yeah, I think that the government has the ability to withhold
sparrows, huh?
That portion of the record. And you asked the question. In the context of your specific question, if somebody writes to the school district and says, I'd like to see a copy of the budget, nothing intimate or personal about that. But on the other hand, if I'm a recipient of public assistance and I write to the Department of Social Services and say, I'm a welfare recipient, you have records about me, I want them. If you disclose the entirety of that request, you're telling the world that so-and-so is poor and on public assistance, and that is nobody's business. And as a consequence, in that kind of situation, our advice has been that the portion of that record that identifies the individual can be deleted on the ground that disclosure would result in an unwarranted invasion of that person's privacy. Does that make sense to you?
Hope so, yeah.
It's different, though, when the record is about the person who's asking for it.
Oh, well, you can't invade your own privacy, right? Right? So if you're asking, as the gentleman did, if he's asking for a record about himself, sure, ordinarily, he would have rights of access. Medical records, there's a separate law in New York that preceded HIPAA by 20 years. And very basically it says, yeah, you have the right to obtain your medical records from either the hospital or the doctor or the dentist, the provider of medical services. Nobody else can get them unless you consent. And we're in a school. How many of you have kids in school? You don't have to be embarrassed about that. Yeah. Anybody here ever hear of the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act? FERPA? Who knows about it? You're smiling. You know about it?
Uh-huh.
How so?
I'm on the school board.
You're on the school board. Okay. I tend to think that, FERPA, federal law, it's been on the books since 1974. I describe familiarity with FERPA as rampant ignorance. I hope that that's not true in your situation. But in any case, parents of students under the age of 18 have rights of access to the records about their kids maintained by the school district. Nobody else does unless the parent consents to disclosure. When the kid reaches the age of 18, he or she acquires the rights of the parents, which means that that person then has rights of access, and nobody else does. Anybody have kids in college? Yeah, where's the kid in college?
Hudson Valley.
You know, you don't have a right to get your kid's grades unless the kid consents. But he's going to an institution of so-called post-secondary education. When my kids were in college, I said, yeah, you damn well better consent. Who's paying the bills, right? Right? You look as though you know. You have a kid in college, too?
No.
You just got out of college, right? More questions? Yeah.
What about the fee structure involved? I know there's like a 25-cent per copy.
Can we move to that in a minute?
Sure.
I thought it was a privacy-related question.
No.
Can I talk about the other branch, which is really important, because it deals directly with the accountability of government. Again, unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. As the courts have considered that exception, as it relates to people like me, people like you on the school board, people like the superintendent, people like the town employee. Are you a town employee?
I'm on the board, yes.
Okay. The courts have said pretty much two things. These are very general comments. Number one, we public officers and employees have less privacy than anybody else. Why? We're supposed to be more accountable than anybody else, right? The public is stuck with us till the next election, till budget cuts, in my case, till retirement or death. Whichever comes first, I'm eligible for both. We'll leave that alone. You can snicker all you want.
What about businesses?
I'll get there. Second point, maybe more importantly, the courts have said in a variety of situations that those items about public officers and employees that relate to their duties usually are public. Why? Because disclosure in those circumstances would result in a permissible
not an unwarranted invasion of privacy. Anybody can learn the salary of any public employee in New York. We are paying the bills, right? You can find out when I come to work and when I leave. You can find out when I claim sick time, vacation leave. All of that is public. If I do something wrong on the job and I have been disciplined, or if I admit to having done something wrong on the job, that record is public. It bears upon how I carry out my duties. It's public. When I go back to the office tomorrow morning, I drove here in my own car. I want to be reimbursed. I'll fill out a voucher. The voucher will indicate what I did, where I went, how many miles I put on the car, the tolls. Each of those items relate to my duties. They'd be public. But to be paid, I have to give my home address, too. My home address is irrelevant to my duties. That item would be deleted prior to the disclosure of the remainder. Questions about that? What do you want to know about public employees? You want to know about overtime? Public. And it's really important. It's really important. I don't know if any of the local news media carry what I've come to call the top 10 stories. Who are the top 10 wage earners, government employees, employed by, let's say, Greene County? I guarantee you that I know who it's going to be. It's going to be somebody who works in the jail or a cop. Why? Because they put in a ton of overtime. They put in a ton of overtime. And usually they put in the overtime during the last couple of years before they retire. That's why we read of these situations where the Schenectady cop last year, I don't want to say earned, but was paid $168,000. Why is that important? Because our pensions are based upon the last 3 years, or the top 3 years in succession, on average, of our gross wages. So they build up the hours based upon overtime, and we pay them for a... I don't know if there are any cops or correction officers here. I think it's a racket. I think it's a racket. If the state wants to save billions of dollars over the course of time, our pension should be based upon salary, not gross wages. Sorry for the editorial, huh?
Those issues were negotiated over Washington.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, the next contract around... Doesn't have to be there. Doesn't have to be there. Yeah.
When you attract a trailer driver and saw the great Green Canyon, they would probably make as much as the county administrator.
Could well be. Could well be. Going back to Long Island, we found out recently that there was a sanitary district in Oceanside. Sanitary district. Pick up the garbage. Guy was making $240,000, not counting his deferred compensation, $25,000 a year for 10 years, not counting the Tahoe that they gave him. That's why we have a Freedom of Information law, to find out how government money is being expended. Anybody here familiar with Delmar? Anybody know Delaware Avenue? Remember the landslide? Gee, I am a mean and nasty guy. And I suggested to local news media, wouldn't it be really interesting to find out which cops earned the most sitting on the side of the road when the road reopened one lane? And what do you think they were doing? Drinking coffee, eating donuts. Yeah. You think they were young cops? No. They were old cops. They were old cops. Well, we found out that the top five in terms of overtime, they were all within 2 years of retirement, number one. We also found out that the guy at the top of the list was the chief's brother. Huh. Didn't sit that well. And there were a lot of taxpayers who said, wait a minute, why should we pay these old cops $125,000 when we can pay four 25-year-olds the same amount and they're actually out there doing what the cops are supposed to be doing? Is that an invasion of privacy? Yes. But is it an unwarranted invasion of privacy? No. And it deals directly with government policy. How did the town of Bethlehem choose to spend public money? I think that that's a real issue. I think that that's a real issue, and people got pissed off. And before the town does something like that again, my hope is that they will think twice. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah, privacy question?
Yeah.
Privacy question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Can your religious background or status affect what is or is not considered an invasion of privacy?
It's one of those things that, in my opinion, unquestionably would be withheld as an unwarranted invasion of privacy. And I don't know of any situation in which the government has information about somebody's religious beliefs. Why would they ask that? Why would they ask that? If the government has it, I think it could be withheld, but I don't think the government ordinarily would have it. But go ahead.
Well, I guess I was thinking more if you as a person, like what you were saying before, two reasonable people could look at the same thing and
you
could
disagree. Right.
I guess I was thinking more in privacy as relates to what's generally considered an invasion of privacy. Has any differences depending on, you know, if you're one religion, you might say one thing is an invasion, and if you're another religion, you might say something else.
That's possible, but again, the standard, according to the state's highest court, is the reasonable person of ordinary sensibilities. And generally speaking, it seems to me that one's religion has nothing to do with government decisions, right? Right? That's why they don't ask. It's not quite like the don't ask, don't tell, but it's sort of like that, right? Who cares? Who cares whether you're Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Buddhist or Muslim? Or what difference does it make in terms of whatever your rights are? And in fact, I should have said this from the start. Under our freedom of information law, who you are and why you want it ordinarily make no difference. You could be from Cairo or Durham or Timbuktu and have the same rights of access. What matters is the nature of the record, right? Who you are, what you intend to do with it, irrelevant. You want to get records and use them to determine the accountability of government? Great. You want to use them as wallpaper? That's your call. Yeah.
I was wondering about EasyPass.
EasyPass.
What's the story there?
What's the story?
I mean, it covers several states.
The Thruway Authority wrote to me before EasyPass was implemented and asked for my opinion concerning the protection of privacy of people who drive on the Thruway, when they get on, where they get off, etc. Nobody's business. It's simply nobody's business. Unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. Now, just to make this clear, obviously the Thruway Authority does have records of when we get on and off. Those records are subject to subpoena. Certainly, they can be disclosed to a law enforcement agency. And EasyPass records have become a pretty useful tool in a lot of contexts involving the ability to solve crimes. So the public at large would not have rights of access, but others might. But let's go a step further. Some of you may remember this. There may be people here, for all I know, who whimper and moan about FOIL. It's a pain in the neck. It is sometimes. But I have suggested that FOIL saves money. FOIL saves money. And I'm absolutely certain that that's true. Some of you might have read the article a while ago, which was precipitated by a request made by the Albany Times Union for records indicating the identities and the amount that should have been paid by people who didn't pay their EasyPass bills. Didn't indicate where they went, but in the same way, if you don't pay your real property taxes, that's public. That's public. If you don't pay your EasyPass bill, that's public too. Well, we found out that the Thruway Authority, through these disclosures under FOIL, was owed $20 million. $20 million. Think about that. So what did the authority do? Well, it was, let's say, a little bit embarrassed. They hired a collection agency. Even if they recovered a quarter of it, and they should be able to get all of it because, let's face it, they know where everybody lives. $5 million as a result of one FOIL request. There's a situation where the disclosures identified people who failed to comply with law. If we fail to comply with law, if I get a traffic ticket, a speeding ticket on the way home, that's public. If I'm arrested for something else and convicted, that's public.
My insurance company does not have access to my password.
No. No. Take a deep breath. Relax. Do you need help?
No, I'm just going to walk over.
You're going to walk over there. Okay. There was another privacy-related question. Yeah? Who you had it.
Yeah, no? I'm just on the request of how you would find out people's overtime if they denied the access to it.
You just asked for records indicating overtime payments made to so-and-so during the period of X to Y, or something like that.
Could be a year.
Could be a year. Your job is to reasonably describe the record, right? Yeah.
Can it just be a verbal request? Or does it only
can it be verbal? Under the law, and I have to give you two answers, an agency may require that a request be made in writing. But there are any number of circumstances where people do make verbal requests. Anybody here a town or village clerk? Nobody's a town or village clerk? Yeah. You don't have to be shy about that. Don't be shy. If somebody walks into your office and says, can I see the minutes of last month's meeting? My guess is that you'll probably say, sure, they're over there. Again, FOIL is supposed to make life easy, not difficult. You could require that a request be made in writing. But why the hell should you do that if the records are clearly public and they're right over there? Again, you make life easy. You make life easy. Yeah?
And I don't know the website, but State of New York, you know the website, the department the person works in, and their name, exactly how much they make.
Yeah.
Not only would they tell you how much
yeah,
you make,
through,
they will tell
through,
you
through
what
through a website called
See Through
See Through New York.
What
yeah.
You didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's because I'm not for profit. Excuse me?
See Through NY.
That's because she wants to know how much other superintendents are in. Yeah. 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 You know, their website crashed 2 hours after it went up because of all the government employees who were so damn nosy. But that's a not-for-profit organization, and through FOIL, it acquired all of this information, put it up on the website for the world to see.
I have another easy pass story. Two of them.
Okay.
Two, 3 years ago, give or take, I got a letter from the great people of the state of Massachusetts reminding me that the speed limit on Interstate 90 going through Massachusetts was 65,
uh-huh.
Not 73.
Uh-huh.
And I also, not the same time, I got a letter from the EasyPass people reminding me that exit 20 on 87, when I go through the EasyPass, is 5, not 22.
Yeah, my kid got one of
they
those,
They let
too.
Me go. Unless it happened to get, you know.
Can I make a suggestion to you?
I suppose, yeah.
Well, that's not what I was going to say. I have a kid who lives in Massachusetts, so we're on I-90 all the time. You get a Red Sox sticker and you put it on the back of your car, it's better than any insurance. I happen to be a Red Sox fan, born in Boston, but that is better than any insurance. Mm-hmm. Believe me. You have the New York plate and the Red Sox sticker, you're golden. I'm telling you. My 3-year-old has a Red Sox hat. My grandson. I don't want to mislead you. He better have a Red Sox hat. Let's put it that way. Somebody had a question about fees. Yeah. Fees.
Well, I understand that there's like a 25-cent maximum based on size, but what about...
Size matters.
There you go. Like 8.5 by 11 or something, it's 25 cents and more if it's bigger, but can they charge you for the research?
Stop. FOIL contains essentially two provisions regarding fees, and you're on the right track. One of them involves fees for photocopies. Photocopies. And the law says that for photocopies up to 9 by 14, the maximum that an agency can charge is 25 cents per photocopy. No fee can be charged for search, for review, for personnel costs, anything like that. The second provision refers to other records, those that are either larger than 9 by 14, not many of them, or primarily those that are maintained electronically. And the law says that if it takes 2 hours or more for an agency to prepare the electronic record, it has the ability to establish a fee based upon the hourly salary of the lowest paid employee who can do the job, plus the cost of the storage medium, which is the disk usually. If it takes less than 2 hours, the only fee that can be charged is the cost of the storage medium, the disk, 49 cents. Most agencies won't charge. Why? It costs more to do the paperwork than it's worth to take in the 49 cents. If you want to inspect a record and it's public, it's free. It's free. I often suggest if the town is audited The controller does an audit. It's 400 pages. I suggest to people, don't ask for a copy. It's 25 cents for a photocopy. You don't want to pay $100. Go in and look at it. Usually you'll find out, I really only want pages 42 and 43. 50 cents. Big difference. Big difference. Okay. Does that help you?
Why is there a charge of $75 or 75 cents for medical records?
Because the public health law, Section 18, says so.
Okay.
FOIL says 25 cents for photocopy or the actual cost unless a different fee is prescribed by statute. A statute, according to the courts, is either an act of Congress or an act of the state legislature. In the case of medical records, Section 18 of the public health law says that a provider can charge up to 75 cents per photocopy unless the person who is making the request is unable to pay. They can't charge you if you're unable to pay. Okay. More questions? Yeah.
You might be able to see we're starting a community radio station. And we've been going to various town meetings and doing recordings. We also like to do, we're also doing a live internet feed right now.
Uh-huh.
We want to do live internet feeds from various town meetings. Your brochure doesn't speak to whether that is acceptable. And if it is, is it also acceptable if we do it with things like new kind of phone lines like Skype or voice-operated internet protocol?
Let's put this in perspective. There are cases that deal with the kind of question that you've raised, but not the specific question. The open meetings law says nothing about the public's right to record meetings. It says nothing at all. But there are lots of judicial decisions, and I should give you a little bit of history. The first case was decided before there was an open meetings law, 1963. In White Plains, a guy brought his tape recorder to a meeting of the city council. Anybody remember the tape recorders from 1963? They were half the size of the room. They were big, they were bulky, they had reels, they moved. And the city council said, no, you can't use it. So-and-so sued. He lost. And the court said that the mere presence of that kind of machine detracts from the deliberative process. Therefore, the city's rule prohibiting its use was found to be reasonable. Second case, Suffolk County, land of hostility. School board member, where is she? School board member brought his portable cassette recorder to a school board meeting. And the school board didn't say, please turn it off. They said, we're calling the cops. You're under arrest. Huh. So the issue went to District Court Suffolk County, which deals only with criminal cases. And the judge said, you know, I read the 63 decision. That might have been right then, but it's wrong now for a couple of reasons. Number one, nobody could have envisioned the passage of an open meetings law, which obviously encourages the public's right to know what's going on. And number two, nobody could have predicted the advances in technology that enable people to use small, battery-operated cassette recorders. They are inconspicuous. For all I know, there are three of you who are tape recording this right now. Anybody doing it? Anybody doing it? I don't care. But the point is that the presence of the device has no impact on the capacity of the government to do its job. Video recording. Cases have dealt with situations where a village board of trustees said, this is distasteful. We don't like it. Another one where members of the public said, we're uncomfortable. This is offensive. The courts said the same thing that they said in 1979. Unless the use of the recording device is in some way disruptive or obtrusive, anybody can record. And the courts also said that we have no privacy interest in our own words when we speak during a public forum. Anybody has the right to attend an open meeting. Anybody has the right to hear what's going on. That being so, if it's recorded, so be it. Anybody can do it. Another case involving FOIL, Nassau County this time, Long Island. How about that tape recording of the open meeting that was prepared by the school board? Hicksville. In fact, it was Hicksville, Union Free School District. Zaleski versus the school board. Do you remember Zaleski? Who's from Hicksville? You remember him?
No.
Robert Zaleski?
Oh, yeah.
Do you really?
No.
I was going to say the world is small, but that's ridiculous. Billy Joel? Maybe. Bob Zaleski? Maybe not. Anyway, the court said, number one, the tape recording prepared by the school district is a record. Number two, anybody could have been there. What's captured on tape is public. Number three, the fee. How do you make a tape recording available? You get another cassette. The cost of the cassette is the actual cost of reproduction. So there you have it. There you have it. In terms of what you're describing, as long as what you're doing does not interfere with the ability of whatever the board might be to do its job, of course you could do it.
But there haven't been any court cases, yes, I guess.
No, but the handwriting is clearly on the wall. There's just... You remember that group? No doubt. No doubt. There's no doubt. There's no doubt.
And if we did it...
Nobody remembers?
Yeah.
Okay.
If we do it with cell phones, isn't there a law against recording someone with a phone without their knowledge?
Funny thing. Who said that?
I did.
You're right. When you call me tomorrow, it's a question that you were too shy to raise tonight. You can record our telephone conversation without my knowledge or consent. Why? Because you are a party to the conversation. And all you need is one party to the conversation to consent. Now, if we were having a conversation and somebody someplace else were eavesdropping, well, yeah, you remember, what's her name? Yeah, if somebody else were eavesdropping on our conversation, that's a different matter. That would be a violation of the penal law. It's called mechanical overhearing of a conversation. That's what we call it in New York. Could have called it eavesdropping, but no. It's mechanical overhearing of a conversation.
Does that take place even when a person is talking with a governmental agency?
Sure.
Governmental agency?
Sure. People record me all the time. You know? I don't care. You know what? You know, you reach retirement age, you can pretty much say whatever the hell you want. Of course, some people will tell you that I've been doing that for a hell of a long time. Anyway. But more questions? Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about the open meeting? What it qualifies for going to an executive session?
Sure.
Also, is there any rule about meeting minutes turnaround time?
Sure. Let's talk about both. But we have to lay the groundwork first. A critical question, one that arose on day one of the open meetings law, continues to come up today. What is a meeting? What is a meeting? And back in the olden days, the term meeting was defined to mean the formal convening of a public body. Again, the school board, the town board, the village board of trustees, the city council, the county legislature, all of those groups of people that are either elected or designated to act collectively as a body are public bodies covered by the open meetings law. In any case, going back, the law referred to a gathering of a public body for the purpose of officially transacting public business. All over the state, various kinds of boards, committees, commissions, they're saying, well, we're not going to vote, we're not going to take any action, we're not transacting public business. This isn't a meeting. It's a workshop, it's a work session, it's a study session, it's everything but a meeting. Well, the issue went to court, reached the state's highest court. It involved the city council in Newburgh, which conducted so-called work sessions solely for the purpose of discussion, no intent to take action. It contended that those gatherings were not meetings. Well, Court of Appeals unanimously disagreed and said very simply, any time a majority, a quorum, gets together for the purpose of conducting public business, that's a meeting covered by the open meetings law, even if there is no intent to take action, regardless of what the gathering is called. Now, to be sure, there may be board members in this room tonight. How many members are on the school board?
Nine.
So let's say that there were five school board members in here. If somebody walked in, would they say to themselves, looks like, smells like, tastes like a school board meeting? No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. There would simply be five members of the board here as part of a larger audience. They would not be functioning collectively as a body. The open meetings law wouldn't apply, even though there may be a majority of members somewhere in the room. Again, on the other hand, if the board is functioning as a body and a majority is present, the open meetings law applies. Every meeting has to be preceded by notice of the time and place. And in fact, there was an amendment to the open meetings law recently enacted. Notice has to be given to the news media,
I say given for a reason. It must be posted physically in one or more designated conspicuous public locations, like that big bulletin board down at the bottom of the hill. And now the law says that if a public body has the facilities to do so, it has to post notice on its website as well. Now, I mentioned notice given to the news media. Any reporters here?
She left.
I'm losing the crowd.
She left.
Lost interest?
I thought I was being educational.
I thought I was being educational and entertaining. Gee. Anyway.
2 minutes of fame
or last thing I care about. Notice has to be given to the news media. What it chooses to do with it is its choice. There are lots of situations in which a board will fully comply with the open meetings law, but nobody knows about it. If the newspaper wants to print it, so be it. If it doesn't want to print it, that's its choice. Okay? But those requirements must nonetheless be met. Going further, the open meetings law, like FOIL, is based upon a presumption of openness. Meetings have to be held open to the public unless there is a basis for entering into a so-called executive session. An executive session is defined by the law to mean a portion of an open meeting during which the public may be excluded. So an executive session isn't separate from a meeting, it's a part of a meeting. And to go into an executive session, a simple procedure has to be accomplished in public. It involves three elements. Number one, somebody on the board has to introduce a motion, again, in public, to close the doors. Number two, the motion has to indicate what they want to talk about. And we'll get to that more in a minute. And number three, the motion has to be carried by a majority vote of the total membership, notwithstanding absences or vacancies. So in a board consisting of nine, if two people are out sick and there are seven members present, a vote of 4-3 to go into executive session or to do anything doesn't carry. In a board that consists of nine at full strength, there would always have to be five affirmative votes to do whatever it is that the board is empowered to do. From there, we look at whether there is a basis for entering into executive session, and the eight grounds are listed on page 14 of your handout. Let me ask, before you look, what's the favorite ground for going into an executive session?
Personnel.
Personnel. Drives me crazy. You know why it drives me crazy? You can read the open meetings law from beginning to end. The word personnel is not there. It's not there. You know, I spoke to the National School Boards Association a few years ago. I asked them the same, what's your favorite word for going into executive session? They all yelled out, personnel. It doesn't appear in the New York Freedom of Information Law. Open meetings law. We just heard about FOIL. There are some elements of personnel records that are public. There are some that are not. Personnel isn't there either. But it's become a catch-all. It's garbage. Throw it away. It should be eliminated from your vocabulary. It's one of those myths. How many times have you read or heard the news report? Oh, we can't disclose this. We can't talk about it. It's a personnel matter. You've heard it, right? There's no law that says that. But, you know, we hear it over and over and over again. And too many Americans have become stupid and sheep-like. We hear these things over and again. We begin to believe that they're true. Not true. And one of my goals in old age is to attempt to explode that kind of myth. As we look at the open meetings law, the language of the so-called personnel exception is precise. Let's think about this. Let's say that the school board is talking about the budget. Says to itself, things are pretty tight. Can we really afford to keep this art teacher position in the elementary school? Well, what if there's only one elementary school and one art teacher? Everybody's going to know whose position it is, right? What do you think? Executive session? Certainly a personnel matter. No. No basis for going into an executive session. Why? Because the question involves matters of policy. How, as the governing body of the school district, do we choose to allocate public money? Is art really important to the education of our kids? No basis for going into an executive session. On the other hand, if the question is, does this art teacher deserve tenure? Then you are focusing on the teacher and his or her performance. Clearly, there would be a basis for going into an executive session. And as we look at the language of the exception, again, it's pretty clear. I'll quote it to you. It says that a board can close the doors to discuss, you don't have to take it down, it's in your handout, the medical, financial, credit, or employment history of a particular person or corporation, or matters leading to the appointment, employment, promotion, demotion, discipline, suspension, dismissal, or removal of a particular person or corporation. Did I get it right? I could be making it up and nobody would ever know the difference, but I don't make it up. So the focus has to be on somebody or some corporate entity in conjunction with one or more of those qualifiers appearing in the provision. Now, I mentioned that there has to be a motion made that indicates the subject to be discussed. If somebody says, well, this is a personnel matter, nobody knows, nobody has a clue whether the board would be complying with the open meetings law. What we've suggested, what the courts have adopted, is a motion under that provision that includes two components. Number one, inclusion of that keyword particular, so that we know that the focus is on somebody or some particular corporate entity. And number two, reference to one of those qualifiers that appears in the language of the exception. I move to enter into executive session to discuss the employment history of a particular person, or something like that. You wouldn't have to name the individual, but if you tell the world that much, what you're really saying is, yep, we've read the open meetings law, and unless we're fibbing, we're about to discuss a subject that can properly be considered during an executive session. Is there another favorite ground for going into an executive session?
Budget workshops.
Budget workshops? I hope not. I hope not. I hope not. You know, what I've suggested 1,000 times, if the board, whatever the board is about to go into an executive session and you're not sure, you engage in what I've come to call the Tracy Chapman principle. Anybody remember Tracy Chapman?
Yeah,
what's the best song of the 90s? Baby, just give me one reason, and I'll turn right back around. Right? You know, it's a great song. It's a great song. Inherent in that is that it must be a good reason. And I suggested to people, that's why I said at the beginning, have this little handout with you so that you can say to the board, wait a minute, board, here are the 8 grounds for entering into executive session. Please tell me where this fits. Baby, just give me one reason. And I'll turn right back around. And if it can't, chances are pretty good, has to discuss the issue in public. Your eyebrows are raised. I mean, what's the story?
They're at a public meeting. Do you have a right to question why they're going in?
Do you have a right to question? That is a really good question. The open meetings law says nothing about the public's right to speak. It says that the public has the right to be there, to attend, to listen, to observe. It says nothing about public participation. That means that if a board doesn't want to let the public speak, doesn't have to. Most boards do permit some sort of limited public participation. Our advice has been very simple. If a board wants to let the public speak, it should adopt reasonable rules that treat members of the public equally, so that they can't say, well, we like you, we'll let you speak for 10 minutes, but we don't like that guy, we'll let him speak for 2 or not at all. Another point, some of you remember this movie. I live in the Stepford School District. Remember the Stepford Wives?
Yeah.
All the kids are above average, and all the teachers are wonderful. At least that's what the school board leads you to believe. Yeah, wow. But we all know that it's not entirely true. Well, there are federal cases which indicate that if the door is open, it's open all the way. Findings of example. In my school district, if a parent gets up and says to the board, Johnny's teacher is just wonderful. God, they love that, don't they? But what if the next parent gets up and says, you know, my kid has the same teacher and the teacher stinks? Sometimes the reaction is going to be, sorry, personnel matter, shut up, go away. Well, they can't do that. If the board is willing to permit positive or praiseworthy comments regarding its staff, it must permit critical comments as well. Now, if the board wants to say, sorry, we won't take any comments that focus on specific individuals, that's okay. Everybody is on an equal footing. But again, if the door is open, it's open all the way. Okay? Now, in the context of your question, my feeling is because I believe in civil disobedience. If the board is about to go into a closed session, you don't think there's a reason, I think you stand up with your brochure and you say, "Board, I don't think that this fits." If you don't do it, maybe nobody else will. And if you don't do it, maybe information that should be out there will never be heard by anybody. The information may be lost forever. You know, reporters ask all the time, "Should I get up and do that?" You know, there are people who believe that if the reporter does that, he or she is involved in making the news. My feeling is, reporters have a job, number one, not to be intimidated, number two, to know something about these laws, and number three, to assert rights, acting in the eyes and the ears of the public. And realistically, it's not January yet, but you're going to have school board meetings on a cold, snowy night, and nobody would be there except for the reporter, maybe. If the reporter doesn't attempt to assert rights on behalf of the public, nobody will find out what's going on. So, does that answer your question?
Somewhat?
Well,
can I make a two-fold question, Bob?
Okay.
Recently, we went to one of the legislative meetings, and they kept us out in the hall for 16 minutes.
County legislature?
Yeah, it's supposed to start at 6, but it started like 6:16, 6:17.
Sure wasn't 6:16 and a half?
Possibly.
Okay.
I mean, can they do that without us just walking in the door? I mean, we tried to, and they said, you know, you have to sit out in the hall, and we're discussing something.
Discussing what?
Well, they were discussing probably getting rid of one of the agencies. That's what they were discussing.
Well, if they're talking about getting rid of one of the agencies, number one, they should have been discussing it as part of a meeting, and number two, there would have been no basis for going into an executive session. For the reason that I mentioned before, in terms of the discussion of the budget, what are the functions of the county? What kind of needs do we need? Do we have to have carried out? Is this important? Can we get rid of it? It's not the same thing as talking about the employee and whether he or she is doing a good job.
But can they go into executive session before they even have it?
No. Meeting? What did I say right from the start? An executive session is a portion of an open meeting during which the public may be excluded, number one, and number two, that procedure that I mentioned has to be accomplished during an open meeting. An executive session can never legally be held before a meeting. So am I upsetting people here?
No.
Good.
We're just loading the gun.
You know? Oh. My suggestion is use it, and use it accurately and well. That's why I'm here, to give you all the education, and I suppose, depending upon your perspective, the ammunition that you need to make sure that the government is engaging in what I've come to call the Spike Lee rule. You know the Spike Lee rule? Do the right thing.
Yeah.
Do the right thing, yeah.
So, a citizen's challenge regarding a procedure.
Yes.
Is that automatically part of the record?
Say it again.
Commentary is not. It's optional. Apparently. Public comment is optional.
Okay, I know where you're going.
Okay.
And it relates to your question too. As we look at the open meetings law, it contains what you might view as minimum requirements concerning the contents of minutes. I can't tell you how many times people have called, board members of the public. I said such and such at the meeting a couple of weeks ago. There's no reference to my comment in the minutes. And I have to say to them, that's because there is no requirement that your comments be included in the minutes. The law contains minimum requirements concerning the contents of minutes. At a minimum, they must consist of a record or summary of motions, proposals, resolutions, action taken, and the vote of the members. They may include more. They don't have to include more. So the comments made by board members, by individuals, they don't have to be included within the minutes. Again, they can be, but there's no obligation to do so. Now, for those people who want to have a complete record of what goes on, what do? You record it. You record it so that you can have a complete rendition of what is expressed during an open meeting. Okay? In terms of the time, how many of you are aware of boards that approve their minutes? Everybody approves their minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no law that says that minutes have to be approved. Are you yawning or just shocked?
No, I've been painting all
day. You've been painting all day. I've heard feeble excuses, man, but that's, I've been painting all day. Artists or rooms?
A wall.
There's no law that says that minutes have to be approved. We all do it based upon history, tradition, policy, not law. However, the open meetings law says that minutes must be prepared and made available within 2 weeks. Huh, 2 weeks. 2 weeks, 2 weeks. Like the Pizza Hut commercial, remember that? $4, $4, $4. Now it's $5. Anyway, what if it is the board's habit, policy, practice to approve its minutes, and 2 weeks have gone by and they haven't met to do so? Simple solution. The clerk, whoever prepares the minutes, should do so, make them available on request within the 2 weeks. If they haven't been approved, stamp them, mark them. Unapproved, draft, preliminary, something like that, so that the recipient has a general idea of what transpired. At the same time, the world is given notice to the effect that the minutes are subject to change. Okay? Does that answer your question?
You'd mentioned earlier about the majority of the body.
Yes.
That the body is, let's say, 14.
14?
Just say 14. Just throw it out
here. Usually it's an odd number.
That's 14.
That's okay.
And you're talking about color or? Never mind.
But
you'd mentioned 14, or you'd mentioned the majority of the body.
Yes.
And they go into any. The quorum, you're saying, has to be the majority of the entire body.
Yes.
Or those present.
No, the entire membership.
The entire
not
membership.
Those present. Not those present. What was the comment? Say it a little bit louder.
I just said you're screwed.
He's really shy, isn't he? Shy and required.
I can clarify that. You mentioned before, nine member board. If we have five people show up to our meeting, they all don't vote yes on something, it doesn't go anywhere. Because five is the majority of the total body.
Five is the quorum.
Five shows up. All five have to say yes to move anything on our agenda.
Correct. You need an affirmative vote of a majority of the total membership to do anything. Except adjourn. You know, what's tonight? Tonight's Thursday night? What's on TV tonight at 9 o'clock? I have no idea. What is it?
Lord
of Failing. That's on every night.
Okay. Gets to be 8:45. It's the board meeting. Five people there. One looks at his watch and says, oh, Survivor's on in 15 minutes. I'm leaving. No quorum. The meeting's over.
Let me ask you one question.
You can ask two if you want.
14-member board, what's majority? 7 or 8?
Eight.
That's majority.
Half plus 1, right? Eight.
Plus one simplifies it. It doesn't matter how many members. Mm-hmm.
But that's a simple. What happens if you have bylaws that say you have to follow the bylaws if they say the quorum is?
You know the word diddly?
Yes.
It's the diddly principle.
Okay.
It don't mean diddly.
Okay.
We have. Let me just talk like a lawyer for a minute. We have all kinds of provisions that are sort of either laws or like laws. Statutes are enactments of the state legislature. A bylaw, a local rule, cannot conflict with a statute. You raise the question about a quorum. If the county legislature says, well, we'd like our quorum to be a majority of those present, that would be invalid because there is a statute, Section 41 of the General Construction Law, which doesn't deal with buildings, but deals with how statutes are to be construed. It's been on the books since 1909, and it said since that time, again, quorum is a majority of the total membership, notwithstanding absences or vacancies, or even disqualification.
What about the committee meetings?
Committee meetings. You're talking about the committee of the county legislature? Just for the sake of discussion? You remember I said a public body is something like a governing body. Well, in the definition of the phrase public body, at the end, reference is made to any committee or subcommittee consisting of two or more of such public body. So let's say that the county legislature consists of 14, its quorum is 8. It designates the personnel committee consisting of 5 of its own members. That subcommittee, or whatever it is itself a public body with 5 members. Its quorum would be 3. So that means that the committee or the subcommittee or whatever it may be has the same obligation to comply with the open meetings law as the governing body itself, in terms of notice, in terms of minutes, in terms of its ability to go into executive session as well. More questions?
So, committee meeting, say there's only 2 people there. I mean, is any
two out of how many?
Out of 3.
Two out of three ain't bad.
Is any committee meeting supposedly open as long as it's not an executive committee meeting?
Executive session.
Right, executive session.
Two out of three. If the committee has three members and two of the three are getting together in their capacities as members of that committee, yes, the open meeting is open.
And they have to give notice.
They have to give notice. Giving notice is easy, right? It's easy. It doesn't cost any money. If the meeting is scheduled at least a week in advance, the law requires that notice be given not less than 72 hours prior to the meeting. If it's scheduled less than a week in advance, the law says that notice must be given, quote, to the extent practicable at a reasonable time prior to the meeting, close quote. Practicable. Whatever the hell that means, yeah. More questions? Yes, good.
If, say there's a committee meeting that they don't open to the public.
Death penalty. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What can you do about it? So they don't open it. They can say, so we're not going to.
Well,
what are you going to do about it?
You can stop the meeting and get on the phone right there from the administrator's office and call them up, and he'll render his rendition over 45 minutes and come back and say, sorry.
You know, there are some teeth in the open meetings law. I'm not going to tell you that they're big teeth, they're sort of baby teeth, but let's say that a board or a committee or whatever it is takes action in private that should have been taken in public. And you bring a lawsuit. The court has the authority to invalidate the action taken in violation of the law. Let's say that that same board engaged in significant deliberations in private that should have occurred in public, and you bring a lawsuit. The court has to award you attorney's fees payable by the government. So there's an attorney fees possibility, there's an invalidation possibility, but just as important, at least in my view, is the court of public opinion. I mean, if the public has the notion that this governing body just doesn't give a damn about complying with law, you know, maybe they'll throw the rascals out. And that's really what it's all about, right? We use these laws to find out what's going on, and if we can't, we find people who are willing to comply with law. I don't think that we vote people out of office nearly enough. Although, in terms of this last election in November, I think people are getting the message. What do you think? There are a lot of incumbents who were voted out of office. A lot of incumbents.
Wait till next year.
We'll see. You know, then if there's a message that you'll get voted out unless you listen to us, maybe they'll start listening. That's what it's all about. I know that people don't like it when I say these things. It's what these laws are all about. That's what our democracy is about. You know, if we don't like the way our government people are representing us, we get rid of them. Newspapers, man, they drive me crazy. So-and-so's doing less and he's that, he's doing a terrible job. Then they turn around and endorse him. Drives me bananas. I don't know why they do that, but we see it far too often. Questions? More questions? Yeah.
Now, what are considered governmental agencies if you've got, say, your state, your county?
City, county, town, village, public authorities, fire departments, yeah.
501Cs?
Ooh, I know where you're going. Volunteer fire companies, usually created as not-for-profit corporations. And not-for-profit corporations, not government, usually.
But we...
However, there was a unanimous decision in 1980 by the state's highest court that dealt with a volunteer fire company. And the volunteer fire company said, we're a not-for-profit corporation, we're not government, we're not an agency, we're not covered by FOIL. Well, the Court of Appeals said, number one, volunteer fire company, you perform what historically has been viewed as an essential governmental function, number one. And number two, you would not exist but for your contractual relationship with a municipality. Therefore, volunteer fire company, yes, you are an agency covered by FOIL. And they spend a lot of money. I don't know that you spend a lot of money, but again, you know, there was a series in Newsday on Long Island. Do you know about that? You're shaking your head yes.
No. I don't know about it. I just nod a lot. You don't have to say that.
Yeah. Is that the same as nodding out because you painted
so
much?
No.
I feel completely dissed. I mean, you know. volunteer fire companies, their budgets are public. The records indicating the expenditure of their money is public. In fact, the case involved a fundraising event. It involved a lottery sponsored by a volunteer fire company. And they said, well, even if we are covered by FOIL, these records have nothing to do with fighting fires. The Court of Appeals said, doesn't matter. They are records. They're covered by FOIL. Remember what I said right at the beginning. Any information in any physical form whatsoever, kept, held, filed, produced, reproduced, by, with, or for an agency. They're records. They're subject to rights of access. More questions?
So basically, any agency that has governmental involvement, like by law.
I don't want to say that, because that's too broad. I mean, think about all the companies that contract with the government. That doesn't make them government. That doesn't make them government. But let's talk about that a little bit more. People often want to find out about those private companies that do business with the government. Private companies are not required to disclose. But if there is some sort of a contractual relationship, the government agency has records about that relationship and often about that company. Those records fall within the coverage of FOIL. So often people use FOIL not necessarily in conjunction with an interest in the accountability of government, but simply because the government has possession of records about whatever the subject might be. FOIL is very broad, much broader in New York than the equivalent statute is at the federal level and many state, other states. By the way, I should mention, yeah.
What about an agency like an IDA, and what about specifically a conversation between an IDA and a private entity?
An IDA is a kind of a public corporation. General Municipal Law, Section 856. People refer to it as a quasi-governmental, and, you know, I heard this on the radio coming down. These quasi, they're talking about the bill that just dealt with public authorities. They're not quasi. They are government. There's no question about it. The IDA is 100% government. Its records are covered by FOIL. The meetings of its board, its governing body, are covered by the Open Meetings Law.
All the meetings are open, too.
All the meetings are open, again, unless there is a basis for going into an executive session. And I should point out that the so-called personnel exception, if you're stuck on the word personnel, is going to give you difficulties. What does an IDA talk about? Often, it talks about the financial history of a particular corporation. It would have a basis for going into an executive session to discuss that kind of issue. But if people say to themselves, personnel, where does it... You know, they'll screw themselves because they won't know what they should know that enables them to make sense out of reality. Right? More questions? Let me add something. Yeah.
Can I have your phone number?
It's in the book. It's in the book. It's not my home number either. It's the office number.
FOIL.
It's in the book. It's right there. It's right there. Something else that I should mention to you. Every once in a while, people will ask me, well, which state has the best freedom of information? My answer is Mexico. Mexico? What?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Huh?
I know the guy who wrote the laws in Mexico.
Who do you know?
Sergio Lopez Ayón.
Sergio Lopez Ayón. He was one of many who participated.
It was a group
then, Oaxaca. Yes. Oh, so Oaxaca, that was the local, not necessarily the national.
No, it was a group that came from Oaxaca. It was the
from Oaxaca, there was a think tank in Mexico City much of the time. Juan Cardenas. You know that name? Are you Mexican?
No, but I lived in Mexico.
In Mexico City or Oaxaca?
Both.
Both? Hmm. Yeah, there were lots of people involved in the process. And just to give you a touch of background, people started to come to me from Mexico with questions right around the turn of the century. And they recognized that 75 years of one-party rule were about to end. And they got ready. They got ready. Lots of people were involved in a reform process. They studied what we did in the U.S. and Canada, in particular in terms of FOI, Freedom of Information. And by 2004, they passed a really terrific law. And I was stunned to read that during the first year of implementation, 40,000 requests were made, and among them, 36,000 were made and answered via email. Wow! How could that be? How could that be? Well, the Mexican government expended a lot of effort and money in developing its Freedom of Information Act. They put kiosks. They put terminals all over the country. And there are stories about people who we would probably characterize as peasants who go to the marketplace or the village hall, tap out their request one finger at a time, and get it. That led us, the Committee on Open Government, to make a recommendation in our annual report in December of 2005. It attracted virtually no attention, no editorial support, no fanfare. It passed. It slipped through the cracks and passed. I believe that it's changing the relationship between the public and government. It is so simple. It says, government agency, if you have the ability to accept a request made by email, yes, you must do so. Government agency, if so-and-so wants the record, send it via email, and the government agency can do it. Yes, it must. So what does that mean? It means that obsessed people can make their request at 4 in the morning. Yeah, you laugh. I get emails at 4, you know, from 4 in the morning. What the hell are people smoking or doing? I don't know. Secondly, people can get often the equivalent of the thick report quickly and easily. And third, since the only fee that we can charge involves the reproduction of records, it's free. So a lot of people are getting a lot of stuff now quickly and easily and for nothing. And from the government's point of view, they are beginning to love it too. Why? Nobody has to go to the filing cabinet to try to find the paper. Nobody has to stand at the photocopy machine making copies. And best of all, nobody has to do the paperwork associated with taking in 25 cents per photocopy. A win-win situation. And the offshoot of that, remember I talked about proactive disclosure? An agency finds that there are various records that are public and frequently requested and significant to the public. What do? They put them up on their websites. The records are simply there for the taking. The government doesn't have to deal with a request. The public doesn't have to make a request. And that's where we're going. That's where we're going. By the way, in Mexico, Mexico created an agency to implement and provide education and guidance under its access to records law. It also has the authority to decide. It has the capacity, like a court, to make decisions about what's public and what's not. It has 5 commissioners. I've known the 5. They are serious about what they do. They're doing a great job. Why? They know that if they appear to be under the thumb of whoever happens to be in power, they are lost. And you know, being in Mexico, not the most optimistic society in the world. Although I think in a lot of respects, forward-looking. But the staff of, it's called IFAI, I-F-A-I, the Institute Federal Access to Information, Federal Institute, if you look at it in English, has a staff of 280. It is the biggest freedom of information agency of its kind in the world. So they have been quite serious about it. You know, in my job, it was mentioned at the start there aren't a lot of states that have offices like ours. For years, there were only 3 of us. Myself, a guy from Connecticut, and a guy from Minnesota. The guy from Minnesota was afraid to fly. That meant that me and the guy from Connecticut were invited to share our experience all over the world. Been to Japan a couple of times, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Bulgaria. I went to Bulgaria in February in 2001. Nobody asked to come along. Go figure. Peru, Venezuela, Mexico, 7 times. They like me better there than they like me here. And now Mexico, as you know, has 31 states. Every state has some sort of a freedom of information.
Okay, yeah.
You say, yeah.
It's not so easy to function at the local level.
I am not suggesting to you that it is. However, dramatic, dramatic steps in the right direction have been made in a very short period of time. So it's a society that is very different from the image that most Americans have. Would you agree with that?
I don't know what most Americans
have. What's the image of lots of Mexicans?
Why are they all coming here?
So
that's just an image I have.
That may be reality, but I think that that's due more to the economy than the industriousness of Mexican people. I think that in general they are hardworking. Certainly, there are many, 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 many sophisticated people down there. So, you had a question.
Can you get a copy of a union contract once it's been agreed upon?
Absolutely. In fact, See Through New York has posted all the teachers' union contracts across the state on its website. Sure.
See-through
and why? Yeah. You can get them online. Or you can get them in the old-fashioned way by requesting them directly from the school district. Yeah.
Location of meetings. Does a public body have to hold a meeting in a public building?
No. No. But the law says a couple of things. Number one, it says that public bodies are required to make reasonable efforts to hold meetings in facilities that permit barrier-free access to physically handicapped people. That's number one. Number two, I'll ask a question. Does the school board or any other board around here have retreats?
Yes.
What do you do at the retreat? I'm just curious.
Training.
I think that there are two kinds of retreats. One is sort of the old-fashioned touchy-feely session. Let's get to know each other better. I don't think the open meetings law applies to that. The other kind of retreat often involves the opportunity for board members to relax, let their hair down, and talk about long-term policies and goals. It's the most important meeting of the year. Clearly, the open meetings law applies. I ask for a reason. If the board here wants to engage in one of those retreats, and they want to meet at the country club down the road 2 miles, that's okay, as long as it's open to the public. But if they want to meet at the Lake Placid Hilton, most people here who might want to attend would not have a reasonable capacity to do so. A court would find that that is an unreasonable location. So it's barrier-free access and obviously a place where people interested in attending have the ability to do so. But you asked about private building, public building. My office, the Department of State, has offices in a private building. It's not a government building. It rents space just like lots of others do. We hold meetings there. Of course, they're open to the public.
Well, I was just thinking of, like, the back room at a restaurant.
The back room. I don't like restaurants as meetings. You know why? What do you usually do at a restaurant?
Eat and drink.
Is it free?
No.
The thought is that you shouldn't, your ability to attend a meeting should not be related in any way to the ability to pay. It should be free. And for that reason, I think a restaurant in general is an inappropriate location for a meeting.
I think what she's talking about is if they leave the meeting and they say three or four of them get together, legislators, and through one party.
Okay, I wasn't saying that, but that's a good point.
Three or four out of how many?
14.
3 or 4 out of 14 isn't a majority. It's not a quorum. They can do whatever the hell they want.
So what happens if it's 8?
If it's 8, the question is, what are they doing? Are they drinking coffee? Are they talking about the football game? Or are they discussing county business? If they're discussing county business, it's a meeting. You know, I've suggested a million times that my hope is that in that kind of situation, there is somebody within the group who is sufficiently knowledgeable and vigilant to say, wait a minute, this is beginning to look like and smell like and taste like a meeting. If we're going to continue this discussion, we should do it later within the confines of the open meetings law. Now, human nature tells me that that doesn't happen all the time. The hope is that it happens some of the time. Right? I mean, the open meetings law is never perfect. Look, you know, this question comes up. Every state also has an open meetings law. Board goes into an executive session to discuss topic X. One of the rules of human nature takes over. They drift into topic Y. Again, my hope is that somebody in that group is willing to say, wait a minute, we're starting to talk about a new subject. We should go back out to the open meeting. Of course, one of the other points, I make this point to reporters all the time. They say, well, how do we find out? Another rule of human nature is that there's somebody on practically every board who's willing to spill his or her guts after the fact. If that were a crime, there would be a lot of county legislators, town board members, city council members, whatever, in jail. But they're not, at least not for that. Yeah.
How did early in the Bush administration, how did the secret energy meetings, how did they get away with that?
Yeah.
For one thing, there is sort of an open meetings law that applies within the federal government. It's not the same as ours in New York. And in fact, as we go around the country, again, every state has freedom of information law. Every state has an open meetings law. They're all different.
How do we compare New York with
other states.
You mean how does New York rank?
Well, are we stricter in the...
I think our freedom of information law is among the best in the world. Our open meetings law, in the scheme of things, is mediocre. It's mediocre, by and large, in my opinion, because the enforceability, if you will, is weak. It's weak. You know, I mentioned that a court can invalidate action taken in violation of the law. What if the issue involves your application to put a porch on the back of your house, and the ZBA discusses the whole thing in private, and somebody sues? What is the court going to do? They're going to tell you to tear down the porch? Doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. The other reality is it takes too much time, costs too much money. Even in states that have strong enforcement provisions, it's rare, relatively rare, that there are lawsuits. Relatively rare. You know, judges don't like to fine their friends. You know, it's reality. It's reality. And people, in too many instances, are afraid to take on the government. You know, there's liable to be retribution. People don't complain about what goes on in a school if they have kids, often because they're afraid that their kids will pay a price. Whether that actually happens frequently, I don't know. But people are fearful. People are fearful of that. I can understand that. I can understand that. You know, we're all irrational about our kids, right? Yeah, we are. More questions? Come on. Any other grounds for entry into executive session you're curious about? Huh?
What is it?
What's the second favorite thing?
Litigation.
Litigation. That's the one. That's the one. The law says that a board can close the doors to discuss proposed, pending, or current litigation. People ask all the time, what's the difference? Proposed, pending, current? I don't know. What we should know is what the courts have told us. And again, the courts have looked at the law in terms of the harm that the legislature was attempting to avoid by creating this exception. And what the courts have told us is that the intent behind the so-called litigation exception is to enable a board to discuss its litigation strategy in private so as not to divulge that strategy to its adversary, who, after all, may be out in the crowd. If you're involved in a lawsuit as a private person, the last thing you want to do is tell your opponent what you plan to do in court. Well, the public body has the same opportunity. But the courts have also said that the threat, the fear, the possibility of litigation without more is not enough to justify an executive session. If it were, let's face it, there would be nothing left of the open meetings law, right? What is it that the school board discusses that might not someday end up in court? So the key phrase to remember is litigation strategy. And in terms of the motion, I'll tell you a story. It's a true story. Guy used to work for the Schenectady Gazette, covered the beautiful little town of Cobleskill. Was at a town board meeting. They just didn't want him to be there. Motion was made, proposed pending a current litigation, get out less. It's the less let's get arrested Hendricks principle. He refused to leave. They had him arrested. Before the judge could determine whether the charge should stick, the judge had to figure out whether the board complied with the open meetings law. And this is what the judge said, and I'll quote pretty much. He's a federal judge now. He said that a motion for entry into an executive session cannot merely regurgitate the statutory language of the law, to wit, proposed, pending, or current litigation. Only a judge would ever say to wit. He said that the motion must identify the litigation. I move to enter into executive session to discuss the case of the XYZ company versus the town of Cobleskill. As in the case of the personnel motion, the idea is to give the public enough information so that it has a clue that the board really is about to discuss a subject that can properly be considered during the executive session. Okay. Questions? Yeah?
Okay, so now the legislator goes to the executive session, but one of the legislators knows enough to know that it's not right. Should he say something?
Sure. For one thing, you vote against it in public, right?
I would say that this preemphasis is presuming that the one legislator knows that it's right or wrong, or what the topic of it is. And once again, this is where all this open meetings come
from. Listen to that one legislator, right?
No.
But that doesn't mean one legislator can't tell the world what he thinks is right. And certainly, if you express it during an open meeting in public before the board goes into an executive session, I'd say that there's a likelihood that at least some will listen to you. I would hope so. You or whomever.
You have a powerful ally in the press. I mean, if you want to be open and to be consistent, and you want to create not just an appearance, but in fact, the substance of an open and effective and honest meeting. And people can discern that pretty quickly. And if it happens two or three or four times, they're really going to discern it. So I would think that the rest of those legislators or whoever they are would want to stay 10,000 miles away from that type of duplicity.
See, I said the same thing before, but he said it much better.
No, I've learned from
you. Thank you. More questions?
I have a question about executive sessions. When you come back to your open public meeting,
yep,
you need to give a comment, little commentary, a generalized.
No, you can, but you don't have to.
You're not required to.
No. More questions? Yes.
So procedurally, do you have to close the meeting, go into executive session, and then reopen the meeting, or are you still in the meeting?
It's still part. And again, an executive session is defined by the law to mean a portion of an open meeting during which the public may be excluded.
So you don't adjourn the meeting. You
don't adjourn. You go into an executive session,
meeting.
Come back.
Do you have to give a guesstimate of how long it'll take?
That's an issue that involves common courtesy. Sometimes you don't know. If it's getting to be a while, it seems to me somebody should stick his or her head out and say, this is taking longer than we thought. It'll probably be another 15 minutes. I think it's just a nice thing to do.
So can you, let's say you're having a meeting and at the you everything else has been discussed and you leave the executive session to the end.
Okay, that's when you tell the public, we're going into an executive session to discuss such and such. We will conduct no other business. If you want to hang around until we're done, that's your call, but you can leave because we're not going to be doing anything else.
Okay, then do they have to come back into like an open room and adjourn the meeting?
You know, I think that's silly. It's silly. You know, what if the tree falls in the forest and nobody knows? It's silly. And again, when people leave, when there are enough people to leave, so there's no quorum anymore, the meeting is over. Period. Right? You know, I think we're too caught up in some cases in this procedure. You know, you remember Aristotelian versus Platonic? Substance versus form. Any here, you know, like Robert's Rules? Even Roberts doesn't understand Roberts' rules. Throw them out. A lot of Roberts' rules is contrary to the law of New York. And if you stick by it, the parliamentarian has all the power. You don't want that. You don't want that. You want to do what works based upon the personality of your body. Right? You do what works. More questions? Last licks.
Back. Does the content of what goes on in an executive session become public after any period of time, or
not necessarily? A public body other than a school board can vote during an executive session. Most don't. Why? If action is taken during an executive session, the law requires that minutes be prepared and made available within 1 week, indicating the nature of the action taken, the date, the vote of the members. Most boards don't do that. They'll just come out after the executive session and vote in public. That is the only situation in which there's an obligation to prepare a record regarding an executive session. If a board goes into a closed session and simply discusses but takes no action, there's no obligation to prepare minutes. Again, there's no obligation necessarily to provide detail regarding what might have been discussed. Now, I mentioned school boards as an exception. Why? Because there's a provision of the education law which has been interpreted by the court since the late 1950s to preclude boards of education from voting during executive sessions, except in two circumstances that I can think of. One involves the initiation of charges against a tenured teacher, where the education law says that the vote to do so must occur during an executive session. The other involves the situation in which an action taken could identify a student. And I mentioned earlier that there's a federal law that says that information identifiable to a student ordinarily cannot be disclosed to the public unless a parent consents to disclosure. Okay. More? Yes?
What if something, say, urgent comes up and the employee of that government body contacts an official because they need immediate relief somehow or another? How would you handle that, reporting that to the public?
Are you talking about a situation in which a board must get together?
Even if they just call you individually and say, I have a situation, I can't wait till Tuesday night, what is your opinion on X, Y, and Z?
Well, I mean, if there's no board meeting, there's no obligation to tell the world about it at all. You can choose to do so if you think that it's important or newsworthy or something like that, but there's no requirement that that must occur. Lots of things may be important that we just don't ever find out about for any number of reasons. More questions? Yeah?
Depending on the political climate, is there ever a possibility FOIL will be repealed?
FOIL will be repealed?
Depending on the climate.
Not in this country. Not in New York. Not over my dead body. Not a chance. Once you give it, you can't take it away. You know, I'm not going to tell you that there's a constitutional right. There isn't. There isn't. It's a statutory right. But think about this. And I have to admit to you that I'm fairly proud of this. How many of you have heard the term FOIL? It's become part of the language in New York. It's a verb. I FOIL this. It's a noun. I submitted a FOIL for that. It's an adjective. This is FOILable. It has become part of the relationship between the public and the government here. Not necessarily everywhere, but here. I don't think it'll ever disappear. It can't. It can't. The other little offshoot of that, I mentioned earlier that I have been amazingly fortunate. You know, I've had this job for a hell of a long time, and again, if I don't upset somebody every day, it's because I didn't go to work. It's pretty simple. And yet, I'm still here. I'm still here. You know, in Massachusetts, they had a similar body, and the director wrote an opinion. The boss didn't like it. He was canned. Nobody contacts them anymore because they have no credibility. Here, you know, the truth is, when you upset everybody, they know you're an equal opportunity pisser off. I'm joking, but I think I've heard from half the people in the state at least once. We have gotten hundreds of thousands of phone inquiries over the years. And again, you know, when you're a staff of three, I pick up the phone half the time. What a luxury. What a luxury to have that degree of independence. Hardly ever does that exist in government. You know, and you mentioned the news media, and I'm going to say this, I shouldn't say it. If there were an effort to do damage to my office or get rid of me, all it would take is one phone call. They'd never forget it. They'd never be able to forget it. There would be 50 editorials around the state within 3 days. I'd make them pay. I'd make them pay. And you know, they know it. They know
it. You said you're going to retire.
I didn't say I was going to retire.
Oh, okay.
I might retire someday. If I feel as I do, you know, I'm old enough to start collecting Social Security. I just can't imagine doing it. I got 35 years in. I can retire any day I want. It's not on the agenda. Of course, the next governor, whoever it is, could can me. But, you know, that remains to be seen. If it's Giuliani, I'm probably gone. You know, when he was mayor of New York, you know, I don't think he really cared about compliance with law at all. He just did whatever he wanted to do. We had lots of disputes with the Giuliani administration. So we'll see. I don't think he's running. Anybody think he's running?
He said no.
There are mixed stories. Yeah, the story in the Times says he's not running, and somebody from his office says, no, he never said that.
He's going to run for Senate.
He's going to run for Senate.
And then,
you know, he should run for his life. What are we talking about?
How do you really do?
Spoil it and find out. Speaking of that, I'm gonna close with this. There are lots of people who are sensitive about seeing their names in print. Yeah, you're shaking your head, yes. There are lots of people in government who are especially sensitive about seeing their names in print. This involves what I have come to call the love letter syndrome. Anybody here ever get a love letter? Come on, tell the truth. Yeah. What do you do when you get a love letter?
You read it over and over and over again. You read it every conceivable shade of meaning. You may remember it until the day you die. Well, what happens when the average person, which includes the average public official, sees his or her name in the newspaper? That person reads the article the way most people would read a love letter. They read it over and over and over again. You read it in every shade of meaning. If the reporter got 95% of it right, 5% of it maybe a tone you don't like or a misspelling or something edited out, the instant response is, I knew I couldn't trust that reporter. I knew the reporter was out to get me. You know, and the reporter is 26 years old, is from South Carolina, has no political agenda. But you who say your name in print may remember that for an awfully long time. On the other hand, because we are so bombarded with news and information, the rest of the world forget about it in practically no time at all. And my suggestion to people in government is that if you see your names in print and they don't have the words murder or indictment next to it, it's pretty good news. It's pretty good news. It's pretty good news. And that, you know, if you see your face on the tube, I do a lot of TV. I'm a walker. I took the bus for 25 years. People would stop me. Hey, Bob, I saw you on TV the other day. I'd always ask the same question. So what did you think about what I said? They always say the same thing. Oh, I don't know what you said, but you know, you look marvelous. It's the diddly principle of what over the There's only one person who's ever cared about seeing my name in print. Guess who?
Your mother.
My mother, because all mothers are crazy. Right? I mean, you know, there would be an article, 24 paragraphs, and my name would be in the 22nd. She'd say, oh, Bobby, there's an article about you. No, Ma, it's not about me. So, with that in mind, last licks. I'll make you an offer you'll never hear from another state agency employee. Ask me anything. Go ahead. Make my day.
Public surveillance tapes made by the government in public areas, are they foilable?
If they are in public areas and they capture what would be in plain sight to anybody who was present, yes, in my opinion, they would be public.
Not during an investigation?
Even during an investigation. If it can be seen by the public, anybody who happens to be there, why would it be anything but public? Now, if, on the other hand, it's a hidden camera, the last thing you want to do is tell people where the hidden camera is, right? I mean, here we are in school. For all I know, you have hidden cameras here. If you tell the kids where the hidden cameras are, they're going to go smoke dope someplace else, right? I mean, in that situation, you don't disclose. But if, in fact, anybody go to Greenwich Village ever? Yeah, there was a big truck there, a police truck, with a big surveillance camera. Everybody knew that it was there. Everybody knew that it was there. And I actually participated in a forum on issues involving privacy relative to this stuff. You know, and all the merchants in the area said, God, we love this camera. All the bad guys would go rob, you know, the stores three blocks away. You know, of course, the people three blocks away said, wait a minute, why can't we have a camera? So, lots of answers to lots of questions.
I have one more question. What about digital recording?
What about it?
And if somebody wanted to have it transcribed, who's...
You don't have to transcribe. You don't have to transcribe.
Do we have to make it available to them, though, to have a stenographer transcribe it at their own expense?
Sure. 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 They can do with it as they see fit once they get it. But you are not required to create that written record typed. That doesn't exist in that form. Okay. More questions?
I just need to elaborate on it a little bit more. On the disk, there's other cases. So how do we just slice out their piece of the pie to keep...
Well, let me ask you a question. Are the other cases public information? Then give them the whole thing. Make it easy for yourself. Here it is. It contains more than what you asked for, but yours is part three. You just dump the disk onto another... Dump the content onto another disk. Make life easy instead of difficult. More questions? Okay. Well, if that is the case, again, I want to thank our host, Superintendent. I want to thank Christine. I hope that this has been worthwhile, educational. And I'll make one more offer. If ever you have a question or a problem about any of this stuff, you know where I am. Better for the woods.
Okay.
Yeah, I can tell. This guy is back. You can't wait. I'm going to be a little bit late tomorrow. My wife has a doctor's appointment, so I got to babysit. So I'll be a little bit late.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.